Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Different Strokes for Different Folks, to find common ground and take it to the next level with David Clark here on Blog Talk Radio. Each week, the show will encourage you to keep an open mind and prepare to open the door to new understandings. We will have an exciting array of diverse guests who will point up the fact that we are all spiritual beings having a human experience. Now your host, David Clark.
Welcome to Different Strokes for Different Folks, where we will indeed be finding common ground and taking it to the max level. I'm your host, David Clark. I'm a spiritual adventurer, and I suggest you become the same. When you keep an open mind, you'll come to see that despite our seeming differences, we're all basically the same. You'll also see where you can find common ground so that you can relate rather than compare yourself to others. Now tonight, my special guest is judge and author Doug McCullough. He's currently a North Carolina Court of Appeals judge. Prior to this, he spent 30-plus years in law, serving on both sides of the bench. During the 1980s, he was a federal prosecutor in Raleigh, North Carolina, back when drug smuggling off the North Carolina coast was at its height. The book Sea of Greed is the account of the drug seizures that eventually led to the takedown of Panama's notorious dictator, Manuel Noriega. And so I would like to welcome Doug tonight. Doug, once again, how are you doing?
Thank you very much, David, for having me on your show. I hope this retro look at the 1980s will be interesting to your listeners.
Well, you know, I think that a lot of people are interested in history, and unless we take a good look at it, history tends to repeat itself. And so maybe we can find some threads to unravel and find ways to curtail some of the activities that took place back in the 80s. Now, how long have you been an attorney, Doug?
I passed the bar in 1970, so I've been practicing law for about 45 years. The last was since 2001. I've been on the Court of Appeals as an appellate judge, but before that I was in private practice and I was a federal prosecutor. So I've defended and I've prosecuted, and now I'm in the middle.
Which do you prefer?
At this stage in my life, I prefer to be being a judge. When you're an advocate for either side, it is a very harrowing, you know, grueling young man's game. I think being a judge is a little more intellectually challenging, but it is not as, you don't have to take on the burdens of your client, you know?
Right. Don't call me, right. I can imagine.
And say, Lawyer McCullough, I thought of this or I thought of that. Or agents aren't calling you out of bed and said, we've got to go get a search warrant at 2 o'clock in the morning. So people don't usually do that to a judge.
Right. Well, how did you happen to get into the case that resulted in your book, The Sea of Greed?
Well, I was obviously a much younger man. I was in my 30s. I was the first assistant in the U.S. Attorney's Office in Raleigh, North Carolina. We cover the 44 eastern counties. And we have a good bit of Atlantic Ocean frontage and secluded harbors. And back in the 80s, our coastline looked much like it did in Blackbeard's day to a large extent. It was more undeveloped, not a lot of waterfront development. There were places where you could slip in and slip out. It was a kind of a smuggler's paradise. And some people were trying to get out of Florida, where it was getting to be more difficult to smuggle. And some locals met up with some people from the Gulf and brought them into North Carolina. We had a seizure of 29,000 pounds of marijuana, but lo and behold, we didn't have any people. We didn't get anybody on the. They all got away, and so I was the prosecutor. And for about 3 years, I wondered if we were going to prosecute anybody at all out of this case.
How did you happen to tie the threads together?
Well, greed, hence my title, Sea of Greed, waterborne smuggling and greed were the two main ingredients in this thing. There was a leadership of three people. of them was from Detroit, and he was the person who had the customers for these groups, a group of people, and he was upset with his security director and had him shot. But God does protect drunks. He was drunk at the time, and the shooting didn't kill him, but it sure looked like he was dead. And he crawled over to a phone, called 911, and if you're ever shot, you want to be shot in Detroit because they have evidently a lot of experience. And they were able to save this man, and he became our principal witness that unraveled this whole organization.
Wow. Well, how did you happen to go about writing the book, and when did that take place?
Well, there was, other than just a normal drug smuggling case, then I developed a case against Noriega and showed that, that the principals, after my one seizure of 29,000 pounds, they never lost another load to law enforcement. They amassed a huge fortune of $50 million, which in today's dollars would be like a half billion. And they laundered it in Panama with Noriega's assistance. And I flipped the first non-Hispanic witness to implicate Noriega, forced the CIA and DEA at the higher intelligence levels to admit that he was dirty, and they probably knew he was dirty. And that's one of those lessons of history, I think, you can say, that when intelligence agencies get a mind of their own, they sometimes use that information for their purposes and maybe don't pass it all on to the policymakers. And so by doing what I did, I forced the issue to go up to the National Security Council, and Reagan made the call that if Noriega was indicted, was dirty, then he needed to be indicted. And Noriega moved further to the left with Castro and then committed some atrocities that just couldn't be ignored, and was invaded shortly after George Herbert Walker Bush became president. But besides those things and the international things, there were some celebrities who were prosecuted. Doc McGee, who was the manager of Bon Jovi, Motley Crue at the time, was a person that I convicted as part of this case. He had loaned him some startup money. And one of the principals, who was a Grand Cayman playboy, flew into Jamaica to have a Locklear's wedding, and we had the Jamaican authorities put him on a plane to New York. So I knew it had a different aspect, and I kept the investigative materials for years and tried to write a screenplay, realized I didn't know anything about that. And finally, my wife galvanized me into working on it, and it took about 3 years for me and Les Pendleton, my co-author, to put a timeline down, use the materials, make sure that we had the sequence right, and then the chapters kind of unfolded the way I visualized them when I was trying to write the screenplay. And so my book reads more like, you feel like you're reading a script, but it's not a script. If that explains it.
Yeah, it sounds dramatic.
Everybody who reads my book says, I can't wait to see the movie. This is going to make a great movie. It's very visual, and it's you see it in your mind's eye as things are being described.
Well, you mentioned to me before the show that somebody has an option on the rights to doing a film on the book. That's very exciting.
It is, because it's actually moving forward. They have a director who's well-known in Hollywood. He hasn't announced it, so I can't really announce his name, but he's on IMDb, and he's done a lot of movies, and he's excited about doing this, and they're perfecting the script, and they just did a trailer this week, which shows this is really about the storyline of Sea of Greed, and it has an interview with me. The principal person that I developed as a witness is a guy named Stephen Kalish, who now lives in Hawaii and was a successful businessman when he got out of prison. They interviewed Kalish and me, and there's pictures of the North Carolina waterfront. There's an interview with the Coast Guardsman who was on the seizure at the time of the events that took place, and they're going to be taking that around to try and develop interest in this story.
Well, how did faith play a role in tracking the case?
Well, I tried to, this case, like every other case, I try to approach the case with total integrity and total candor, and those things that you learn by following the teachings of Jesus and being honest with people. And in the criminal prosecution world, let me tell you, there's a lot of deception, and some people play it close to the line, if you know what I mean. And with Baelish, I was totally straight up about what would happen. And we were in a bit of a federal turf war between our office and Tampa, Florida. And Tampa wanted to bury Kalish. And I said, Stephen, I think I can get you a better deal, something that you really deserve if you cooperate, but you've got to cooperate with me and trust me. And we developed a level of trust based on integrity. And I think that permeated our handling of the case, and that's why it eventually was able to be successful, integrity and honesty.
Well, those are qualities that certainly are a valuable commodity if we're going to lead a spiritual life. And I am very interested in hearing a little bit more about the book.
Well, I hope you will get a copy of it. If not, maybe I can send you a copy after this interview is over. But for your listeners, it's available wherever they get books, whether they go to Amazon.
And I assume it's available on Amazon.com, too?
Oh, yes. That and several other electronic sites, as well as just going into a bookstore. And it won't be on the shelf in a book in Syracuse, New York, but any bookstore there can order it.
Now, if somebody wants to get in touch with you, what's the best way for them to do that? Do you have a website?
I have a website. It's seaofgreedbook.com, and there is a way to email me there, and I follow those. And there's plenty of information about how to get in touch with me through the website, seaofgreedbook.com.
Well, I'm curious, were you ever intimidated by Noriega, and what can you tell us about the man?
Noriega never really figured out who developed the witnesses until probably in the middle of his trial or the discovery process. So I never really was confronted by him. And the organization that I was investigating, I had the chief witness and I had people arrested. So this particular group did not necessarily intimidate me. But that doesn't mean that during my career as a federal prosecutor there weren't others who did. And one you may recall that I was quite concerned about was the Montana Freeman. You remember those right-wing ex-convicts back in the late 90s who were up in Montana and they had negotiations with the FBI and that type of thing? There were others who, and those people I was definitely concerned about.
I vaguely remember that. What kind of man is Noriega?
From my perspective and listening to the witness describe him, Noriega was a very greedy, venal, ruthless man. He probably had people killed to get to where he was. He had people imprisoned and murdered to protect his position. I know for a fact that he flew to Washington, D.C. on a Learjet that was supplied by this drug dealer that I was prosecuting, and then he flew to Las Vegas on his way back to Panama and partied with showgirls, and they say a lot of cocaine was present and used during that period of time. So I'd say he was a man that had no scruples and no morals, and he would do anything to protect his position, including murder.
Now, did the drug cartels ever get through to you?
No, they didn't get through to me because, I was pretty well insulated here in North Carolina, and they really never figured out who developed the witnesses. Now, my witness, Stephen Kalish, had to serve his time in one of those protective units that the prisons have for cooperating witnesses. So everybody in his institution was a cooperating witness, and he was offered witness protection program, but he did not take it when he was released. He just went and became living a life of low radar. He didn't put himself out there. But he became quite...
Sounds like a brave man.
He was, in many ways.
Did you ever feel threatened at any level along the line?
I was concerned at first, right after we developed the information about Noriega, because that information went up through three different agencies, and I didn't know how people at the top would react. And in fact, I thought professionally threatened when I got a phone call from people in Washington in the Assistant Attorney General Criminal Division's office one day, and they told me to get up to Washington the very next day. That's kind of unusual. And I got up there at 10 o'clock the following morning on a flight from Raleigh, and they said, go to a conference room. And I went in there, and my friends from Tampa were there. They didn't know why they were there either. And shortly afterwards, the Assistant Attorney General of the Criminal Division came in and told us that it had gone to the National Security Council, and Reagan had said for Noriega to be indicted. A little relief at that point.
I can imagine. Well, I'm interested in how you were able to use the real people without permissions.
Well, everything I did is from the public record. There were trials, okay. There were investigative reports that I have the copies of. Many of the people were people I actually interviewed after the FBI had interviewed them, and I used them as witnesses or things in trials. And then there was an extensive amount of journalism that was matters of public record that I was able to get, as well as the court cases and reported opinions from federal appellate courts. So there's a great deal of information. And once you're a public figure and part of a public case, you don't really have any rights to object to something that's out there from being utilized.
Right. Well, what are your plans after this project?
Well, I'm researching another book about another case that I had was a woman smuggler who was actually friends with Joan Jett, used to hang out with her and go skiing with her. In fact, was on her way to go skiing in St. Moritz with Joan. But I think I'm going to use her character and just write a totally fictional story that still accurately mirrors the times of the 80s and the Studio 54 lifestyle. And I think would be really an interesting story. I could say it would be inspired by true events, but I want to make it a fictional so that the results will turn out differently.
Well, that sounds like that will be an interesting project too.
I'm going to have her end up on a Caribbean beach. I'm not going to have her end up in a federal prison.
Had you ever planned to write a book in your past, or how did you happen to pursue that particular course?
Well, I thought that the events of Sea of Greed and some other cases that I'd had actually had entertainment value, as well as could teach some lessons, and I wanted to try and get those out there. But writing is hard, and maybe I wasn't energetic enough, and so I just kind of let it sit. And I remarried not too long ago. Well, it's a long time now, 13 years ago. But my current wife, found the materials where I had been struggling with this project, and she really galvanized me and held my nose to the grindstone, more or less, to get this story out and get it out there and get it told, because a lot of people remember Noriega even today, know who he was. They know he was brought down by the army using rock music that blasted him out of his hiding place in a Catholic church or a Catholic institution. But other than that, they really don't know why he became our enemy or what were the events that led up to this. And I felt like it's important for people to know the history of why something happens and how one person doing the job the right way can make a difference, and why you should do your job that way too.
It sounds like your wife is your muse.
She is everything that you want a wife to be, and she is, and she saw this story, and she said, what was this that you're writing a college paper or something? And I said, no, and I told her about it. She said, you've got to tell this story. And so from then on, it was going to be told.
That's great. It must be very satisfying to have the project completed.
It feels really good, and what really feels good is I started off self-published, and there's not that many people who come out of the self-published world and go into the published author world. And to have just crossed into the published author world for about 2 years or so, I was a self-published author. And then just this past year, I have an actual publisher and an agent, and people take an interest in the story and see the potential. And I have yet to find a reader who said, you know, this was a really boring book.
Well, how did you go about... Go ahead.
The reviews on my agent's website are indicative of what most people think about my book.
Now, when you say you're self-published, do you have other books out there?
No, I don't. This was my first book, and like I said, it was a self-published book, and then I was introduced to this lady who's the agent, and then she found me a publisher, and so I have an actual real publisher. Just, you know, they have about 80 authors that they publish, and or the publisher is more than that. My agent manages 80 authors. I'm one of hers, and then the publisher has probably several hundred authors that they publish their work for.
Well, it is amazing that you crossed over from self-publishing. I've never heard of a book being picked up by a traditional publisher that had been self-published to begin with. How did she ever manage to do that?
Just on the merits of the story and what it stood for. And the story, the book is, having been published by a real publisher, the book is a great improvement because you do get to work with an editor, and the editor smooths out some of your language, and it gets rid of all those punctuation and typos that you might have missed when you're self-published, and it gives it, it is a professional work now, whereas a lot of self-published works look what they are.
Exactly.
It's an amateur trying to be professional, and now it's right.
Was it a challenge finding an agent who would champion your cause?
It was a challenge finding an agent, and I had tried things like going on the internet. I had sent some out, and most of them really were not legitimate that responded to me, and the legitimate ones were too busy, and it was very hard to find the right one. Fortunately, I had a friend who had writes a kind of a different type stories, and he was familiar with these people and introduced me to Jeannie Loacano. And Jeannie took a look at my work and decided that she would like to be my agent and represent me, and she thought she could get a publisher interested in it, and she did.
Boy, that's great. That must have been such a relief after all of the efforts that you'd put into trying to find an agent.
Well, it did. I can imagine your listeners would appreciate the statistic. There's something like 3 million books out there that are self-published, but I think the directory of books in print is something like 65,000 to 75,000. So just there, that statistic going from 3 million to 65,000 is huge. And none of those 3 million can be on Amazon or any of these other electronic sites. You know, you can't order it, get it on your Kindle if it's self-published. And so you have to be published and in print to be able to reach people. And now I've got a chance to reach people. And if it is made into a movie, a lot of people will learn from this. And as you said at the outset, there are different levels to this book, too, because there is an implication that some of the intelligence agencies were playing a little fast and loose with Noriega. They had a saying, he was a man who couldn't be bought but could be rented from time to time. And they were happy to pay the rent and kind of ignore what else he might be doing.
Well, is there anything else about the book you'd like to tell us?
I think we've really kind of covered it. I appreciate the opportunity to be on your show, and I hope that I've piqued some people's curiosity, and they want to see what it was like and know what the 80s were like in this particular era, because I described this not from the law enforcement side, but what it was from the smuggler's side. And there's some Wolf of Wall Street type over-the-top partying and living that these guys did that I fully described. It's true. Going out on cruises for New Year's Eve out of the Caymans and planning their next big smuggling event, things of that nature. So there's a I do describe the interplay they had with the entertainment world, and it's not just a cops and robbers type story.
Well, it does sound fascinating. I'd love to read it.
Well, I hope you do. I'll come back.
Well, Doug, thank you for joining me tonight. I really appreciate it, and I wish you the best of success with the book, and I'll be looking for the movie in the movie theaters.
Well, thank you, David, for having me on the show, and I hope your listeners have enjoyed our show today.
Okay, well, thanks again, and so now we come to a close. Let's pause and reflect upon the idea that we are all united through the diverse tapestry of our individual gifts. There is no real thing as separation except in our own minds. We are each unique expressions of the ultimate source of our beings. We are spiritual beings having a human experience who can and will have a spiritual experience if we let it be. Have a great week, and remember, whatever you dream, you can realize.